we drop. We're dealing with now the fact that it seems like we lose the descent when we start getting some moisture, some rainfall. In other words, the moisture is getting into the joints or somewhere, that we may be dealing with a metallurgy corrosion problem to the point of saying, hey, you know, maybe we've got to go clean some contacts, which of course not having a 100-foot bucket truck to lift each section off, clean it off, and then maybe coat it with some silicone or moly glue, molybdenum grease or something like that is obviously out of the question. But it occurred to us today that there's a possibility of some dissimilar metals. The tower is Rhone 45G, and I wonder if you've run into this problem before.
Wow. You did say 2 meters, and you did say desensitization. I own 100 feet of Rhone 55G, and I also own 100 feet of Rhone number 6, which is very similar to Rhone 25. The way the two bolts go through each and every leg of a Rhone 45 tower, and the way those legs are galvanized, for the junction of a tower leg between an upper section and the lower section, with that galvanizing, if the tower is not heavily rusted on the inside, which I doubt, the chances of that giving you descents are very slim. If you've got water in the coaxial cable connection of your transmission line to the antenna that's on the tower, and first of all, when you're talking about 2 meters, I'm reasonably sure you're not radiating with the tower itself. You've got some kind of an antenna on the mast or hanging off the side of that tower. How do you know that the descents, first of all, you're probably unhappy about the fact that your sensitivity on 2 meters is not as good as it should be, assuming you've got the right kind of a low noise amplifier. And by the way, many 2 meter rigs start off with 12 dB of noise figure. In the sideband node, if you're not adding a preamplifier in front of it, you're not getting full sensitivity. What's the evidence of the descent? Give us a few more words on this, Dennis. Whiskey 2, India Uniform, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, as far as coax, no, we've just replaced the hard line. We're using, I think, 7/8 or so, I'm not sure at this point, but we've just replaced that. We do have a copper grounding strip at the bottom, and of course I do know that there could be a metallurgical reaction between the copper and the galvanized steel that these things are. I believe it's the 440 receive antenna, which is at the very top, and yes, the 2 meters antennas and transmit and so on are on braces or so off the side of the tower. There was some evidence that we were radiating from the tower because the descents, we've tried a separate receiver, when we drop.
Yeah, stand by a second now. Dennis, are you talking about a 2 meter repeater? And during the time that you're transmitting, the receiver is desensed. In other words, if I measure the sensitivity of your receiver with the transmitter turned off, and then measure the sensitivity with the receiver turned on, or transmitter turned on. That's one of the main definitions of repeater receiver desensitization. Is that what you're being victimized by? Wait for the beep. You've got it, Dennis. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Correct. It is 2 meter and 440 repeaters on this tower.
And did you do a measurement of receiver sensitivity by way of, let's say, a directional coupler-like device on the antenna lead? In other words, you open up the antenna lead from the duplexing filter output, the one going to the transmission line to the antenna, insert some kind of a blitz bug or some kind of a power insertion device. With the transmitter turned off and a signal generator that's synthesized, you slowly crank up and measure either 12 dB of synad or 20 dB of quieting, whatever. You measure receiver sensitivity. Then you turn on the transmitter and measure sensitivity again. A difference in those readings with the transmitter on is true desensitization. To your knowledge, Dennis, is that the exact test that was done? Give me that information first. Over to you, Dennis. Wait for the beep. other words, your downlink ranged from repeater to a remote mobile rig is good, and when that mobile rig wants to talk back, it doesn't hear. So you've got a dead receiver for some reason. You suspect desensitization. Has anyone measured the bare foot sensitivity of the electronics irrespective of the antenna? I mean, if your repeater is a real hot one, it might have 0.07 microvolts of sensitivity on its receiver measured at the duplexer antenna connector. I wonder if you happen to know what is the sensitivity measurement in microvolts or dBm, any units at all. What I recommend you do in a case like this, Dennis, and I've seen many cases like this where the downlink is working like a charm, the uplink seems to be pretty sad, and you're going to have to do a divide and conquer. Let me drop.
WA2RYY.
W4YY. Joe recognized. We'll get to you in a minute. I do recommend you do a divide and conquer. In other words, first of all, if you inject the signal straight into the receiver, you get a reasonable number of microvolts of sensitivity. Then when you inject the signal through the duplexing filter, which duplexing filters easily become detuned on the receiver side, you still measure the same sensitivity per se. It would be nice to be able to inject a signal at the back top of the transmission line at the top of the tower. Of course you can't do that. Then you do this transmitter on and off test to find out if some form of leakage from the transmitter is causing grief into the receiver. There's a whole series of tests that I think should be done to find out is a fish or fowl. I mean, is it an antenna problem? There's a slim possibility something funny is going on with dissimilar metals on the tower. But that's a long shot. That's the last one I would look at. Tower itself causing it. A fault in the antenna. A fault in the transmission line. A fault in the duplexing filter. A fault in the preamplifier. A fault in the filter that's protecting the preamplifier. A fault in the lightning projector that's protecting the whole thing. A fault in the receiver itself. I mean, there's a zillion places that can create lack of sensitivity, and a series of tests should be done to find out what's going on. Otherwise, the whole group could, in the worst case, end up chasing their tail for 6 months. I've seen many of those. Joe has seen many of those. Joe has set up quite a few repeaters. He's going to give us now a little bit of the benefit of his experience. WA2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Can you hear me okay?
You're sounding good. Go ahead.
I would attack the problem by simply dividing is it an equipment problem or a feed line and transmission problem by terminating the duplexer with a suitable dummy load that's capable of handling the power of the transmitter completely and using a directional coupler at that point on that installation and isolate that equipment to make sure it operates correctly into a 50-ohm load, completely duplex transmitting without any desensitized receiver. Because if you don't do that, you could really, really go crazy trying to figure out what it is. It could be a bad duplexer cable between cans that's giving you the grief by wiggling the cables. You can easily see that by doing a localized type of test. So that's the first thing I would do. Isolate it. Is it an equipment problem or is it a transmission line combination feed line type of problem? Another thing in common about duplexers, real quick, a lot of these duplexers do not have very, very good out-of-band rejection. So sometimes you put a duplexer on, you think that's all you need, that's all there is to it. And you find that you're on a comm site type of installation. You got a lot of stuff that's way, way out of band, but it's coming down your antenna at a tremendously high amount of level as far as dBm. And that can drive preamps and likes totally, absolutely crazy. You may think, well, something on high band should bother me. It absolutely can.
That's good suggestions. So, let me list them in the order. If this is the best of all worlds, this is what you would like to know, as I see it, Dennis. Does the barefoot receiver have the right sensitivity with its preamp? Does the barefoot 7.5-foot receiver have the right sensitivity when you inject the signal directly into the duplexing filter. When you put a high-powered dummy load on the duplexing filter and turn on the transmitter, says, do you get the exact same sensitivity with a directional coupler at the dummy load? Then remove the dummy load and put on the real antenna and repeat that measurement. If the real antenna as a load has a brand new lower, poorer sensitivity, that's telling you that the antenna is doing something funny, either because it's picking up strong signals that are doing something, saturating your preamp way out of band that you didn't know about, where you need an extra bandpass filter to protect the low noise amplifier. Is there a passive intermodulation distortion device? One of the things that Joe ran into once, which was a real killer, is that nearby to his antenna during one of his tests was a chain link fence at similar altitude. That's not your case. But the chain link fence with all of those junctions of all of that galvanized wire, the way the chain length is constructed, was creating passive intermodulation distortion. So lots of measurements. These measurements, when hopefully you're running a tape recorder, and even not, you can go to, let me drop this. In a couple of days, you can go to the website and play this all back. And so, let's see, we're on reel number three. Reel number one is from 8 to 9, then 9 to 10, and then 10 to 11. Reel number three. We're going to be on reel number three at the website of amateurradio.tangovictor. www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Everything you're hearing right now will be at that recording in a couple of days because of the heroic effort that's being done by Mike Perry, Kilo Charlie 2, November, Juliet, India. I don't know where the guy gets the enthusiasm to do all this documenting and recording and whatever. So these series of measurements, they sound elaborate, Dennis. To a skilled guy with the right kind of equipment, in 1 hour, he's got 8 answers, and if the 8 answers are in the right combination, you know exactly where the problem is. So with and without dummy load, with and without real antenna, with and without transmitter turned on, sensitivity measurements of your receiver will eventually, with the proper analysis, tell you exactly where the grief is coming from. You can skip all of those steps if you want to, and you can chase your tail for 6 solid months, and I've watched a number of repeater groups do that. You either bite the bullet and find out where is the grief, or you come up with a bunch of guesses and a bunch of hypotheses that nobody bothers to confirm, and someone comes along and says, I know it's this, and so you got to do so-and-so. Well, if he hasn't done it with a measurement, there's high risk and a low probability that the first guess and the fourth guess is going to be right. That's a bunch of opinions. Consider the thought. Whiskey 2, India Uniform. I wonder if any of those measurements have been made yet to your knowledge, Dennis, T2RIW in the TechNet.
Give him a simple way of doing it, too, Dick.
Dennis first, and I'm going to go over to Mel. Go ahead, Dennis.
Okay, I got the beep. Okay, to my knowledge, I have no clear-cut answer that they have been done. So this is the reason why we come to you. Someone who's as experienced as you guys are with this stuff, it's time to find out what we should be doing instead of, you know, groping at, putting straps from one joint to the other and making sure that they're soldered on and all that sort of stuff has already been one of the suggestions just this morning. So, I mean, good to know. I've got it as amateurradio.tv. It should be up there in the next few days, so this way I can play it all back because my note-taking ability was getting to that point where Dick emailed this to me.
W-H-Y-Y, would you like to comment?
Joe recognized you're going to be FML. To put a strapping device between the legs of the tower on the hypothesis that the tower was presenting dissimilar metal passive intermodulation distortion, wow, is that a long shot? I give you that one chance in 1,000. Not impossible, but one chance in 1,000. That's somebody with a theory that popped into his head, and I'm going to be a little bit severe here. I've seen many a person who have an idea that suddenly pops into his head. The person makes the assumption that because the idea dwells in my head, it's got to be 99.99% accurate. Well, if you believe that, I would like to sell you a bridge in Brooklyn, if you know what I mean. You gotta make measurements, and that's a long shot, not impossible. And before you go through the heroic effort of properly soldering, which to do good soldering on a tower, you're going to be using high temperatures, disturbing the living daylight out of the galvanizing that under normal conditions is good for 25 years if you don't start scraping it and damaging it, whatever, with a blowtorch in order to do this soldering. Oh, terrible. I don't recommend that. Until you confirm that by the dummy load versus antenna with directional coupler in both cases, measuring sensitivity of the receiver with and without the transmitter turned on. Until you fail that test, which means that with the dummy load you measure a good sensitivity with the transmitter turned on, with the real antenna connected and the directional coupler you measure poor sensitivity with the real antenna, and then you didn't put a spectrum analyzer on the antenna to look for DC to light, all the frequencies coming down that antenna to find out if anything is strong enough to be deep.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
To use a spectrum analyzer to look at all frequencies DC to light to find out if any strong local signal coming down that antenna is doing something terrible to the preamplifier, which requires an additional protection filter. Until you've done that kind of testing, which can be done in a fraction of an hour, to spend a couple of man days strapping every one of those junctions on that tower for the long shot thinking that that might be it. Wow. That's, from my mind, very far left of center, but maybe I'm being emotional about this one. Mel, I bet you've run into some things like this. What's your suggestion? K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Hey, this is K2KEY. A friend of mine in Pennsylvania, they started to also complain that all, you know, the receiver on their repeater was just not making it. He said, it just doesn't have it anymore. And he said, maybe it's the antenna, maybe the duplex. I said, wait a minute. I mean, they had no test equipment. I had nothing with me. It was just a business. Dick, I just took my handy talkie. And I stuck my handy talkie. I disconnected it. I had somebody just call in one of the guys from a distance away. And I just used my handy talkie as a comparison. I said, let's take a look as a just using it as a receiver. And I could see the difference. I said, yeah, just with my handy talkie, it's outdoing your repeater receiver. I said, something is wrong in the front end of the repeater. Most likely, maybe lightning, static damage. And sure enough, when he sent the repeater away, he had it repaired, was all fixed up. So, simple repair can many times be done just with a handy talkie as your test instrument. If you haven't got, you know, the elaboration to really do it with a test instrument initially, Dick, over.
It's a little bit different, but that's not a bad suggestion. See, an ordinary Hewlett-Packard 608 signal generator, a so-called driftometer, you could never really measure the repeater with that unless it's been warmed up for a week and fed with a constant temperature and a constant power. So a modern-day frequency-sensitized signal generator is required. Well, a reasonably good brand, Handy Tucky, maybe it has to do some extra shielding to it, with a step attenuator after it, could inject weak signals into the repeater to measure sensitivity. At least it's frequency synthesized, and it would give you some rough measurements. And you know how much power you're starting off with and how much step attenuation you're using. I know that getting the test equipment to the site is going to be a little bit of a problem. But you guys in New Jersey are in an area of very high technology, Dennis. You guys have got friends and contacts. You will eventually get a hold of spectrum analyzers, synthesized signal generator, vector network. You'll get a hold of some sophisticated test equipment. New Jersey is loaded with it. Choose the right guy, the right company. Speak to him the right way. Pass his palm with some silver. Give him a six-pack or whatever. You will get the right test equipment. Without measurements, you can easily chase your tail for 6 months. With the right measurements, a smart guy is going to have the full answer for you in under 2 hours. I guarantee it. If a smart guy with the right test equipment, and you want to know of the 10 possible causes, which one? and you could waste an awful lot of time on the other nine. I've seen this happen very, very many times. It's a classic problem, not an easy solution if you try to do it without test equipment, without objective measurements, in my opinion, Dennis. Whiskey 2, India Uniform. I'm not trying to scare you.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Not trying to scare you, but I'm trying to lead you in the right direction, and I know I'm being a little bit severe. W2, India Uniform, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Actually, Dick, on the contrary, you're not being severe, you're being very helpful, because this is the kind of stuff that is not occurring in the thinking, which is what we need to bring out to the club at this point. And as far as spectrum analyzers, we have a member in the club who sells to the useless government the spectrum analyzers, and I mean, I've seen something like 48,000 samples per second. So I think we've got the tech equipment right in our hands. It's just a matter of getting some time from him to connect this thing to it, and also make some of the other tests. So just let me confirm with you that I've got the right website. Drop it. Amateurradio.tv, and that's Tango Victor, and nothing like .com or anything like that after it. And we'll check out that site and re-listen to this on later on in the week.
Right on. Whiskey.amateurradio. Run together. Amateur ending in R and radio beginning in R, so the two R's together there. No punctuation between them. Amateurradio.tangovictor. Nothing else. You then go with, you'll see, it'll open up to a beautiful page. You'll see the Long Island Technical Net, or Limark Technical Net, the award-winning Technical Net. It was just awarded the Technical Service Award for 2010, this particular function that you're listening to. And you go to, as I said, most likely the recording will not be there until Tuesday or Wednesday. Occasionally it's there on Monday, but by Tuesday or Wednesday, everything you're hearing tonight will be there. You can play it back. And so with a dummy load that's big enough for your particular repeater, so that you can turn the, without the antenna, you can turn the transmitter on and off while measuring sensitivity with a good directional coupler. I wish there's a book we could lead you to that really indicates these measurements nicely documented. I'm going to ask both Mel and Joe and anyone else, does anyone know of an ARRL book that really tells you this kind of information, how to confirm proper operation of a high-tech modern-day repeater? Does anybody know of a book or an article that covers that? Please give me your call letters right now. If not, you're going to have to go with the information you just got in the last hour, and hopefully that'll do it. K2RIW, listening for any suggestions on this.
K2KEY.
Bell recognized, and anyone else?
I have a comment about using something else in lieu of a directional coupler.
Okay, we're going to go to Mel and Joe in that order. Mel, go right ahead.
Yeah, well, recent issue, I don't know if it's still in print anymore. Did they do away with the VHF antenna book? The VHF antenna books, I've had a number of them, and I don't know how far up they went, but I remember the old ones that described setting up repeaters, setting up and how to tune and adjust duplexes and all. So I assume that, is the ARL still have the VHF antenna book, which was, you know, went through the whole rigmarole of VHF and UHF, both transmitters, transceivers, and repeaters. Dick, do you have any of the recent books? Over.
No, out of print.
Thank you, Bernie. Sorry about that. I wish somebody had written an article indicating these test procedures. And the reason for the directional coupler, and Joe's going to give us some more words on this, is that with a directional coupler, and the directional coupler, when you're doing receiver sensitivity measurement, and the directional coupler is mounted at the high-power 50-ohm dummy load that is substituting temporarily for the antenna, that directional coupler doesn't have to have a coupling coefficient any better than, let me pick a number, minus 70 decibels, something that can just squirt in a tiny amount of signal, where 99.9% is the real 50 ohm dummy load, and with the, you can do it with a T connector. A guy could homebrew a T connector in such a way that with a great big gap on the third port, which allows you to inject an extremely weak signal with very little disturbance. What you're trying to do here is called an in vivo measurement. In the living animal, under working conditions, you're measuring sensitivity. First with the 50 ohm dummy load, confirming that the electronics is working correctly, because you get the right kind of sensitivity, way better than a tenth of a microvolt of sensitivity. And then when you connect the real antenna, that's the real living animal in vivo measurement with the directional coupler, squirting in this very weak signal down at the shack. If there's any change in that sensitivity, then it's time to start investigating why, who's doing it, extraneous strong signal or passive intimod. Let's see, when it comes to that directional coupler, I bet you've got some good suggestions, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
But it does give you a way of putting a very, very controlled type of level signal in, of course, the particular point to go to your the input to your system. You should first measure the sensitivity of the receiver through the duplexer. And if you don't have a directional coupler, you can use a magnet antenna placed as far away as the length of the cable will permit you to do so. Hook to the output of your generator. You'll have to turn up the generator to some sort of level to get a signal to be coupled into your into everything. It's going through all your wiring, whether it's going around the duplexer or through the duplexer, it doesn't really matter. It simulates an on-the-air signal. Now, you can, it'll work with a dummy load on the output of the system and where you connect to the antenna. The only thing is you have to be very, very still once you use that type of method, because anything that moves within a couple of feet of the repeater, including you, will change how that signal arrives and how the receiver determines it. So you have to be very still when you do that kind of thing. But that gets you around if you don't have a directional coupler. And the advantage of that also is it lets you test all your equipment without having any connections open and with other terminations in between, like a directional coupler and so forth. You're testing all your equipment as it is supposed to be connected.
Yeah, interesting. I'm a little worried about that one, Joe, because when you're connected to the dummy load and you're squirting a signal from a signal generator into some kind of a local antenna, as far away as you can put it, you're not sure, is it leaking in through the dummy load connection? You wish it was. It could be bypassing the duplexing filter and coming into a snake path in the receiver by way of a B plus, not being enough bypassing or whatever. So the results could be a little bit confusing. So I would strongly recommend a real directional coupler. I would rather see a guy use a type N T connector right at the 50 ohm dummy load. And now at the third port, which is going to be a little bit of an impedance bump, but not worry about it, with an extremely loose coupling, as if you you connected a piece of cable to the third port going to a signal generator, but you back out that piece of cable so that now there's a great big gap. The center conductor of the cable is not touching the center conductor of the T connector, but there's an air gap in there with a and you got to make sure you don't wiggle it during the measurement. That allows you inject a weak signal, and now whether or not the weak signal you put in changes in sensitivity with the transmitter turned on or the transmitter turned off is a biggie, because 50% of the time, in my opinion, when you've got desensitization, when you've got desensitization at a repeater, I think almost 50% of the time it's caused by your own transmitter. There's 50 ways your transmitter can do it. Number one, something is not quite aligned correctly on the transmitter, so that its spectral purity is not as good as it should be. In other words, the side lobes coming out of your own transmitter, 600 kc away from the transmitting frequency, which is your receive frequency, the side lobes coming out of your transmitter could be injecting extra noise. The duplexing filter needs an extremely careful alignment to reject that transmitter noise that is there 600 kc away. a real good duplexer at the receiver frequency is rejecting the signal from your own transmitter by 120 decibels or more. That's a very careful alignment test procedure and whatever. And a duplexing filter that's more than a few months old has been put under any kind of adverse condition by somebody bumping into it or touching it or whatever, or just plain aging, can easily go out of alignment with 120 dB of rejection of the transmitter port at the receiver frequency. If it doesn't have 120 dB of notch there, you're going to suffer, and you're not going to like it. But to realign, to correct an error in your duplexing filter, that's where it is. And 50% of the time, that's where it is, as opposed to the next thing that can happen after that, let me drop, is the lacing of the wiring. If your transmitter and receiver are running from the exact same power supply, and if you have added a preamplifier to the repeater, and the preamplifier you've added is, let me guess, pick out a number out of the air, an advanced receiver research preamplifier. Beautiful piece of equipment. Fantastic noise figure. Fantastic gain. It's got two good points. It's got one terrible point. It doesn't have enough shielding for normal repeater operation. Unless you build a real well-shielded box around that particular preamplifier, if you just take that barefoot preamplifier and put it in a correctly operating repeater, barefoot with the transmitter turned off, you'll measure fantastic sensitivity. But because it doesn't have 120 dB of shielding of its case around that preamplifier, in many cases it cannot survive unless you've got very careful layout. So it's got to be an extremely well-shielded preamplifier if you added it. Another thing people will do is they want to boost up the power output of a repeater, and they buy a Mirage amplifier, a 100-watt Mirage amplifier, and they use that in repeater service. Wow. That has no shielding of that case. When that thing is putting out 100 watts, 2 or 3 watts is roaring out of that 12-volt lead that's coming out of that box. It doesn't have a real sophisticated bypass filter capacitor. And that couple of watts of transmitter power roaring out of the 12-volt lead, spraying all over the cabinet, being fed by your 12-volt power supply, can that give you grief in a repeater? Wow. That'll drive you up a wall for a year if you don't realize how crazy it is. You've done an extremely logical thing. Until you get into the nitty-gritty of all of the isolations that are required to make a single-site repeater.
Repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
A single-site repeater requires a hell of a lot of sophistication of the way the wiring is done, the way the B-plus is fed to all the stages, the shielding of all the critical stages, the careful alignment of the duplexing filter and whatever. A hell of a lot of things have got to be just right. There's 50 ways you can do it wrong. There's very few ways to really make it work right. You see where I'm going here, Russell? I mean, Dennis. I'm not trying to scare you, but I'm trying to give you a little bit of a feeling for the fact that unless you've got very experienced people, if a group of very enthusiastic, fairly well-informed people say, I want to set up a repeater, at the instant you say those words, unless you've set up 4 repeaters and maintained them for the last 5 years of life, unless you've got that experience, when you say those original words, you're about to walk across the world's biggest minefield in my mind. W-2, India Uniform. Hang in there, Dennis. You're going to get to the bottom of this. K2RIW in the tech net.
Hey, okay. Listen, let me say thanks for all the help, especially the fact that I can play it back, because, believe me, it's been an outstanding situation here, and I've got a dog that wants to go outside. She's staring at me with that look on her face. So, gentlemen, let me say 7-3, and again, thank you. It is so very much appreciated what we've gotten started here. The VHF handbooks, let me drop. The VHF handbooks, I have all 3 editions. The first and the second, I don't believe had anything on repeaters, but the 3rd edition finally included FM and repeaters. So I've got them and can certainly lend them to the club as far as, you know, how to do this and how to do that. I'm sure some of it is old hat for some of the guys, but nevertheless, it's a resource that thanks for somebody bringing it to our attention. Let me get out of here, let you close your net, probably join you again next week and let you know what we're doing. Thank you so much, Ever. W2IU, good evening.
And to Jim, would you like to ask a question?
Dennis, do come back next week and let us know step by step what you find out, because the path you're going down, a ridiculous number of people have gone down that path and run off the path into the minefield. And so if it happens to you, don't feel bad. You're in good company. What you're about to do is not easy. There's a zillion ways of doing it, not so well. Let us know step by step what's going on. Mel, I know that you and I opened up a subject last week of the technical correspondence on the subject of return loss. At your suggestion, I read the September issue 2010 QST magazine on that section written by the technical advisor for ARRL. I came very close to writing him a letter until I got into the nitty-gritty. And there's a degree of correctness in what he's saying. Give me your impressions. I know that you had some pretty strong feelings on this one last week, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY, yes. That's what I'm alluding to. Now, wait a minute. Let's finish up here. Is there anybody else that we missed or something that we should go back on? Because I don't get no emails telling us that, we're not fair. So let's finish up, and then I will get into the article in some detail a little later on, Dick. First, make sure that we covered all territories tonight.
KC2, QAQ, with a quick clarification.
Yeah, we did do the first pass of all the people who signed in, and we're about to go back for the second pass. I was going to take a little bit of interruption for this particular article, but go ahead, Glenn, with your additional info.
WS1 has a space science report. That could wait until after Mel.
Yeah, I think we should do that right after Glenn. Glenn, Mel, Glenn, Paul, Mel. Go ahead, Glenn.
Mine's a quick one, Dick. I just want to know, every time I hear on the TechNet somebody mentions, well, actually you or Mel most of the time are talking about the ARRL antenna handbook. Now, I've looked all over for an antenna handbook, and I might just be sticky about this, but are you talking about the ARRL antenna book, or is there something different that I'm missing here?
It is the antenna book, and everybody calls it the amateur radio amateur's handbook. And I think the official title is the handbook for radio amateurs or something like that. The antenna book is the book, and I think it's updated almost every year. Back to you, Glenn.
Yeah, actually, I wound up buying it because it's an interesting publication. There's tremendous information inside of it. And I also bought, there's like seven other, I went on the ARRL website and picked up the other seven compendiums that go along with it. And it's very, very good reading, and I'm glad you guys are always referring to it, but I think a lot of people's questions could be just answered there alone, Dick. Thanks for the clarification. Back to you. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Now, I've worked YL comments. SYL. Go ahead, Bill, with your comment.
Relating to the previous discussion on the QRP antennas, I don't know if we completed that discussion. As I was listening, I got to take a dipole with you and a basic tuner. Was there anything else part of that conversation perhaps that I missed or I didn't quite understand? Back to Ned.
When it comes to a guys who go into the field and want to do ham radio on top of a mountain, at a beachfront, at a park or whatever, a dipole hung in the trees, a sloping dipole, a long wire antenna, any of these simple wire antennas for HF purposes with a antenna tuner is about our best suggestion. After that, we got hung up for a good long period of time about slingshots, bow and arrows, a rubber ball, a golf ball plus a tennis racket, various techniques, and the fishing rod technique for launching things into the tree to get some altitude for the antenna. The more the altitude, the better. So that's as far as we went with that one, Bill. Let me go over to the space report. I get an awful lot of very friendly email from people who say, gee, although this is ham radio, real science is what NASA is doing. And Paul, from week to week, tells us what NASA is doing, and people really love it. One of the things I looked up, Paul, let me drop, was to find out that Mars rotates something like 24 and three-quarter hours per day on Mars. So it rotates a little bit slower than the Earth. Also, Mars has its axis tilted 25 degrees compared to the Sun, we can say, where the Earth is 23 and a half degrees. So as far as summer and winter is concerned, Mars has almost equally as severe summer and winters because of the amount of tilt of the axis as the Earth. That's the good news. But Mars is a hell of a lot further away from the Sun. So the average temperature is a hell of a lot colder. But when we talk about spirit and opportunity being in summer and winter, and now that we know that on Mars, the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn are 25 degrees away from the equator, where they're only 23 and a half degrees away from the equator on the Earth, I now have a gut feel for the similarity. Also, you were telling us about the ammonia loop pump that's doing the cooling on the International Space Station. I think they've now got that operational. I think they're back to full cooling. They found that the mysterious leak apparently replaced that pump that was drawing high current and had to be turned off. So I'd like to believe the space station is back in operation. And I did do a little bit of looking at that spacecraft that I can't think of the name of right now that's heading for those two asteroids, Ceres and, can't think of the name of the two asteroids, but approximately a year from today, we encounter the first asteroid. It goes into orbit around it and makes some very, very interesting measurements. When you go to the NASA site and look at that, the one thing they don't make clear is how does it get into orbit? This new spacecraft is being fed, let me drop, almost all of its thrust for tremendous amounts of time is coming from an ionic engine, which gives you 30 times more efficiency than a chemical engine. That's the good news. But it produces as an amount of thrust that's equal to a weight of a piece of tissue paper. It's a tremendously small thrust, extremely high efficiency, turned on for months at a time. That's where the thrust is coming from, to get that spacecraft out there to the asteroid belt. But then it's about to go into orbit around the first asteroid it runs into, the one that's planned to run into. And I think you have to burn a chemical engine to do that. They didn't make that clear on the website. They make it sound like everything is done with the ionic engine. I'm not convinced that an ionic engine can put you in orbit around the first asteroid, and then after being there for a while, it's going to blast out of that orbit and go to the second one. So you might have some words on that one, Paul. WS2N, our space expert, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, I guess we'll go backwards to the last thing first. Yeah, that's called Rosetta. That's actually a European Space Agency mission, but we have NASA equipment and everything on board that. That's going to, two different asteroids. And when they catch up to these asteroids, you know, the asteroids in the orbit around the Sun, they're catching up to it, but they're approaching it very slowly by the time they do catch up to it. So I guess they would just turn it around and fire the ion engines for extended periods of time. I'll have to check to see if they're going to use chemical thrusters to do that. You could go into an elliptical orbit and drop down slowly but surely. That could be done. It'd just take a very long time. Yeah, that would be Rosetta. I remember when that thing was launched, and we dropped it. And because that thing is so far away from the Sun, you would have think that they would have used the plutonium engines on board, to what they use for Voyager or something, or what they use for Cassini. But they didn't. They went with solar panels, and they're huge solar panels because they're actually past Mars. You're looking at like 2 AU, so it's probably four times less power that you would normally get if you were flying a spacecraft using solar panels around Earth. So these things are huge solar panels to get the power to run those, run everything on board. I'll have to check on the ion engine story, though. Check on Rosetta. Let me drop it.
It's the Dawn mission, not Rosetta, Dawn. In 333 days, it encounters the asteroid Ceres, I think it is. It's the first one it's going to encounter. Back to you, Paul.
The Dawn mission. Oh, okay. This is talking about the Rosetta mission. That one's supposed to go to two asteroids, and I believe that's supposed to eventually land on one, too. But, wow. The Dawn mission. That's definitely an ion mission. I don't think Rosetta is ion. That's why the one that didn't ring a bell. Oh, okay. You cleared that up. I think that was 2014 for Rosetta as well. Did you say Dawn is... what year is Dawn, Nick?
Dawn was launched 2 years ago. It's going to encounter Vista first in 333 days, stay there for a certain period of time, and then go on to the asteroid Aries. In each case, it spends quite a bit of time at each one of those asteroids by going in orbit around that asteroid. You approach an asteroid or a planet, and you're going to whiz by it. You have to do a significant amount of deceleration, velocity deceleration, right at the instant you approach that heavenly body in order to go in orbit around it. And the Dawn NASA website does not make that clear. They make it sound like everything is done with this ionic engine. And I know that the ionic engine, with that flea power, very efficient thrust, but flea power, can't put you in orbit. So something else is going on that's not quite clear. And just like you said, it's got a huge solar panel, 26 feet wide. That's quite a solar panel on a single launch spacecraft. That's something that's built up like the International Space Station. What was it, 85 feet? I think it's 65 feet is the width of the solar panels. Tremendous area of solar panels because it's so far away from the sun. Back to you, Paul.
Okay, yeah, and I remember when Dawn reading about that. It doesn't have a chemical engine on board, though. I'm positive about that. Rosetta, I'll have to look up. I think that's all chemical. But very good. I don't think they have any kind of chemical rocket to slow that thing down. So we'll have to check that one out, though. I will read about that. Probably take about 5 minutes to bring that up on the computer later tonight. I want to bring up Mars Science Laboratory Curiosity. Last week, I had mentioned that this thing, this is the one that's going to be launched in 2011, November. But originally, I remember reading, and they were going to launch on a Delta II rocket, same rocket that brought up Pathfinder, and they brought up Curiosity, Odyssey, and Spirit. Not Odyssey, Opportunity. And there we go, Odyssey's around Mars. Okay, it's the same one that brought up the two landers, Spirit and Opportunity. But that's not what it's going up on. They're not using the Delta II. They need a bigger rocket to drop it. That's why they're going to be launched on an Atlas 541, a 541 Atlas. Much bigger rocket, much heavier payload. You're talking about roughly a 5-to-1 ratio of landing payload on the planet itself. Opportunity is Mars now is roughly around 400, just under 400 pounds. This thing is just around a little over 2,000 pounds, so you're almost like a 5-to-1 ratio for weight. Big difference in weight. So they needed this Atlas 541. The reason they call it 541 is the housing around the top of the rocket that encompasses the spacecraft Curiosity is roughly about 15 feet. So it's 5 stands for meters, so it's like 5 meters in diameter. That's where they get the 5 from. The 4 they get from the solid booster rockets that are attached to the Atlas rocket for the extra boost. You could launch an Atlas without them. You could put 3 on. You could put 4 on. You could put 5 on, like when they launched the rocket that's going out to Pluto, New Horizons. They had a 5 for middle designation, so it was a 5-5-1. The 1 stands for the Centaur rocket that's on, the second rocket on top. Liquid fired engine, liquid fuel engine that's on top. So that's where they get the 5-4-1. That's what it's going up on. Let me drop it. And okay, I thought we covered the tilt axis on last week, but I remember we talked about it. But yeah, Mars is a little tilt over, a little on its side, a little further. But one other thing is, you had asked last week about where these things landed. Both were actually south, south of the equator, but just a little bit. We're talking about one is like a degree, and the other one's like another couple of degrees. That's about it. South of the equator of Mars. That was their landing position. It wasn't like they put one on the south and one on the north. Both of them really shot for the equator there. So that's the landing spot. And the other thing I wanted to mention was, if anybody has cable, there's a good weekly show on. They've already done 3. It's called Explore the Universe. Let me drop it. Sorry, Explore the Solar System. Explore the Solar System. It's being done by this guy. I've seen him before, Brian Cox. He's a physicist, and a young fellow, really does good. Very, very well spoken. And he explains, whatever the topic might be. Like, the first week was, they discussed the sun and how it affects all the planets. Like this last week, they went by the atmosphere and the different atmospheres around the other planets, what's involved and why they have them, why they don't. He does very good. In fact, he talked about it. Let me drop it. He talks about Saturn and the moon Titan. And, for years I read, there could be methane lakes on the moon of Titan. Maybe there is, maybe there is. We think we have pictures, we think we don't. Well, this is the first time I finally heard. I read conflicting stories. This guy said that this was definitely confirmed, that there are liquid lakes on that moon. And they knew there was methane there, and they had a land that it went in and all, but what really did it was the pictures from the Cassini spacecraft itself going over the northern pole of Titan. You could see these big liquid, dark methane lakes. They got in close enough where they could get through the haze, and they estimate them to be like much bigger than like all the lakes of Lake Superior and Lake Huron. You combine them all together. That's how big we're talking about. So, first time you found a liquid lake of any kind, it's not water, but on another surface other than the Earth, I think. That was the report. Back to you, WS2N.
Thank you, Paul. As I said, we get quite a bit of favorable mail of people who just love hearing about NASA because their particular cable system or whatever is not giving them very much information. And those are some of the people doing some really pure science. Mel, with reference to this technical correspondence by Ed Weatherhold, the thing that bothered me a little bit at first is the fact that when you graph something you call return loss or insertion loss, the way you graph it, of decibels become a bigger number as you go down the page. And if you ever do any graphing programs, you realize that until you force the program to see negative numbers, it will not display things like that. It will always display the bigger numbers up higher. So the mathematics of the program requires negative numbers. But it's all a matter of English. If you call it the scattering parameter S11, that is a magnitude almost always with passive components, that less than unity is real return loss. And when you convert that to decibels, it has to be a negative number. But if you took that, if you talk about the return loss, the word loss really means that you expect it to be a number, and you don't put another negative in there, so to speak. When I return, when I talk about the insertion loss of my coax cable, I can talk about the insertion gain, it's a negative number. I can talk about the insertion loss of my coax cable, and because of the definition where you expect it to have loss, you call it a positive number. I don't like it. I don't think he's going to be able to easily sell this, but a number of authorities have sort of agreed with him. And it's a tough one. A neophyte person learning electronics...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
A neophyte person learning electronics sees the word loss, sees it as sometimes represented with a negative number, then plugs in another negative sign and it becomes a positive, and you get results that are crazy when you try to plug in numbers to the equation. On top of that, the equation itself for, what is it called now, return loss, is 10 log P in over P reference, P reflected. When you put the thing that you're measuring in the denominator instead of the numerator, you're doing it backwards. Normally the thing that you're measuring, you put in the numerator, and the reference thing you're comparing it against, you put into the denominator when you're doing a log conversion. And in order to force the number to come out positive, they've inverted it. The thing that they're measuring, they put in the denominator, and the thing that's the reference is in the numerator. So as you can see, no matter how you do it, there's going to be some confusion. I'm not convinced there's an ideal way. Maybe you know a solution, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Exactly. I know Ed Weatherpole and 2N because I've had some correspondence with him dealing with filters. He really is, as they say, somewhat of a maven on filters. First, let me ask one question. Gee, I had this on the email. I am back from some young in a class, and I was holding it for when we had the discussion, the space portion of our net, and the question was asked, did the weight of the Earth more or less stay constant over the millennium up to the time that we started launching aircraft or spacecraft? In other words, was the Earth's weight the same for all the millions, thousands and thousands of years or whatever until we started launching? In other words, is it actually the Earth getting lighter because of all these spacecraft that go over?
Fantastic question. And by the way, you'd be amazed how much we misunderstand the values of things. You have the average person draw you a picture, a schematic diagram of the Earth. And they'll draw a round circle, and maybe they'll put some lines on it, making it look like a globe. And then they draw an atmosphere around it, and they might draw the atmosphere as something that's one quarter of the radius of the Earth. Many people believe that. The atmosphere is, the majority of the atmosphere only goes up for 6 miles, and it starts getting real thin real fast. So you got 6 or 8 miles of atmosphere in 8,000 miles of diameter. Therefore, that globe that sits on your desk shows you a 10-inch or a 12-inch diameter of the Earth. The thickness of the paint on the globe is very close to the thickness of the atmosphere. So you may think that